Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand. And donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Australians are from the future. It's literally tomorrow over there. They're 16 hours ahead of Toronto. So yeah, they're living in the land of tomorrow. And they're about a year ahead of where we are going in terms of media policy. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that they're more advanced or progressive. It's just that Australia, our Commonwealth buddy, the bizarro world Canada from the upside down, they did a thing. And we're copying that thing. And that means we get to see how that thing is going to work out before it actually happens here. And it is going to happen here. So here it is. The news from the future. And that news is no news. On Facebook in Australia, the news just disappeared this month. Here's a summary of the whole thing. Australia's big news companies, largely that means Rupert Murdoch, they are dwindling. They are headed for extinction. But for now, they still wield tremendous political power, both through their pages and behind the scenes. And they've been using that power to lobby the Australian government to come to their rescue and save them from Facebook and Google. Otherwise, they warn, the news will die, and democracy along with it. Australia's government did as it was told, and earlier this month was set to introduce a link tax. That's basically what it sounds like. It is a policy mechanism, it's called the News Bargaining Code, to force Google and Facebook to pay a tax, not to government, but to newspapers. Every time somebody posts a link to a news story on Facebook, and every time a search produces a link to a news story on Google. The big tech companies were unsurprisingly not into paying link taxes. And hate big tech as you and I may, they did have some pretty solid points. First of all, if newspapers don't want to be linked to, they can just push a button and not be linked to. Secondly, the premise that Google and Facebook are stealing news is pretty shaky. You know, the little bits of metadata content that get scraped when you link, the headline, image, few words of text, those are not news stories being stolen. Those are little teasers that news publishers actively offer to the world in the hopes that people share them and are intrigued enough by those little bits of information to click through, read the article, create some ad impressions. Maybe one in 1,000 visitors buys a subscription. I mean, if you happen to enjoy the delicious smell that wafts from the window of my bakery onto the busy sidewalk out front, you're not stealing my fucking cupcakes. And how can I be expected to pay a fee every time somebody walks past and takes a whiff? I cannot control that any more than Google and Facebook can control how many times people share any given news story. Fourth, and dropping the bakery analogy, The entire internet is just a bunch of sites linking to other sites. How are you going to write a law for just two websites? It goes on and on. Whose job is it going to be, asks Big Tech, to decide which sites are official news sites deserving of link taxes and which are not? Do we really want Facebook executives making those decisions? And even if that is somehow sorted out, how much? How much is a link tax going to be? Who sets the price for each link? Is it based on the actual value that links generate for Facebook and Google? Because according to Big Tech, that's not really that much. News links, they claim, actually don't generate that much ad revenue. So that was the argument from Big Tech as to why this is a bad idea. And the response to that argument from Rupert Murdoch and the Australian government that represents him was, fuck you, pay me. And Google in Australia ultimately said, ugh, fine. But Facebook in Australia upped the ante and said, no, fuck you and everybody who even looks like you. So that's why the news disappeared from Facebook in Australia, along with thousands of other sites that seemed vaguely newsy or news-like or news-adjacent, including public health sites and other essential information. Facebook was blasted for this strong-arm tactic, but it worked. The Australian government blinked and changed the news bargaining code in a way that gave everybody what they wanted. Facebook got a wee little amendment to the legislation that basically renders the whole thing moot. They won the right to cut backroom deals with news companies that will prevent the legislation from even applying to them. Rupert Murdoch and the other big news organizations, they got what they were after, free money. Google coughed up two Australian news publishers about $123 million a year to spare themselves from being regulated, and a reported 90% of that is going to go to just three companies, Murdoch's News Corp, Seven West Media, and Nine. A similar split is expected once Facebook is done paying off its torturers. And the Australian government got what it wanted too. Even though their bill was widely criticized and ultimately gutted, they are now able to claim that they stood up to Big Tech and won, and Rupert Murdoch's newspaper, The Australian, is rewarding them. Politician Josh Frydenberg is being praised in the pages of The Australian for his irrepressible, epic negotiation with the tech overlords. And now there's buzz that he would be great as Australia's next prime minister. So there you go. It's a win-win-win, right? Except for the news readers. The public. What do they get? What the Australian public is going to get is a return to a corporate-curated news menu. Google is calling it Showcase. We'll see how Facebook brands it. But what it is the reduction of a wide open public sphere to a curated shopping mall of choices. You know, we're back to the world of NBC, ABC, or CBS. We're back to CNN or Fox. We're back to Coke versus Pepsi. This actually solves a problem for Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg has already said that he wants to depoliticize Facebook. Get rid of all that angry, divisive political stuff. It's been nothing but a headache, and it's turned the public against big tech. So, the infinite universe of information options that we've had access to is being redescribed, rebranded as a rat's nest of misinformation and fake news. People are better off rid of it. I don't expect big tech to ban and block independent and alternative news sources completely. I'm sure that they'll have a little box somewhere in the back for us all to share. Okay, did you see what just happened there? Did you notice how I started off that last bit by trying to describe whether the Australian public won or lost, but then I veered off into self-pity, wondering aloud, what's this going to mean for me? I can't help myself here. I mean, this is usually where I would throw to an interview about what this is going to look like once it hits Canada for you, the news-reading citizen whose perspective I am meant to represent as a media reporter. But I'm also a media publisher, and I do care about the Canadian citizen and the Canadian newsreader and the Canada Land supporter and the Canada Land listener much more than I care about the Australian citizen and the Australian newsreader. But I, of course, am primarily focused on what is this going to mean for my business. It's just too easy to paint a very scary picture for you about how bad it's going to be. And it is scary. I mean, this is government, old media, and big tech getting together and cutting a deal to protect each other's interests. That does scare me as a citizen. You know, in an abstract way, that is a frightening concept. But come on, it obviously scares me in a very direct and immediate way as a tiny independent publisher. So let's flip it. Today, I am not talking about the threat to the independence of the press or the attack that this represents on the beautiful principle of the open internet. Today, I just want to know what this is going to mean for my business, for Canada Land. I have been angry about this stuff on a theoretical level for a long time, but it's not theoretical anymore. It's getting real. And so today, I'm going to try to understand what it is exactly that I have been so angry about. Our government is saying wild things about going way further with this than Australia. They're talking about bringing in a link tax, yes, but they will also be taxing media companies in order to fund CanCon. They are talking about seizing power over which content media sites feature to audiences. They're talking about regulating the content itself to prevent harmful material. So later on today's show, I'm going to talk to internet law professor Michael Geist about what I should be preparing our business for if we're going to survive this. But first, I'm going to call an Australian me to find out about what it's like when your media company disappears from Facebook and your whole existence is like an afterthought to battling giants. Susanna George is the founder of Urban List. They cover lifestyle stuff, travel, style, entertainment, health, and they are Australia's largest independent digital media company. Susanna George joins me from her home in Sydney, Australia, in a moment. Wait for it. This episode is brought to you by Kristen Kirby, Kevin Derbyshire, Riley Webb, Scott Zilioto, Tamara Power, Luis Mota Campo, Serena Jackson, and Peggy Stockdale.
I'm Peggy in Toronto, and I support Canada Land for its investigative reporting, attention to overlooked stories, and calling the media out on its shit.
So, in essence, the federal government tabled this plan to regulate how Google and Facebook could serve news content. And the thinking behind that regulation was that Facebook and Google were generating a lot of advertising dollars as a result of the content on their platform. And they wanted to correct this imbalance and make sure that Australian media companies who produce that content got a clip. Google and Facebook argued that they provide the benefit of eyeballs to the media companies, so the media companies themselves can make ad dollars. The big legacy media companies argued that they were not getting their fair share. By contrast, the majority of the smaller digital-first publishers acknowledge the ecosystem. We acknowledge the sandbox that we play in. We acknowledge that Facebook and Google are extremely important part of this. And we provide them content, they provide us traffic, and that is a win-win. So not completely, there is definitely friction in the ranks, but in general, if you polled the majority of us, the general consensus is that the good outweighs the bad. So the code was well-intentioned in its attempt to recalibrate this balance of power in Australian media. What it appears to have instigated, however unintended, in my view, is the inverse of what the ACCC stands for. So that's our anti-competitive board in Australia. And that's where what has actually eventuated is a really high stakes risk of digital first media being squashed in favor of these big legacy networks. One of the big issues in the code for me is the way that the code defines news media, and we don't fall within that definition. So Urban List would not be able to, under this code, be protected, be at the table and able to negotiate. However, we have absolutely been swept up in the blanket ban that has occurred. So for us, it became a lose-lose situation and quite frustrating that the body that is really created to protect sort of smaller businesses, independents, really avoid any behavior that could be construed as anti-competitive, unintentionally have created this pressure cooker situation where it is we smaller independent publishers that have the most to lose.
In fact, it looks like it could have been a lose-lose-lose. I looked at the Australian law and they published a Q&A. Tell me if I got this right. It would exclude you from core news and include, you know, Rupert Murdoch's papers. But once big newspapers get in the door as core news, and as such, they're qualified to receive compensation from Facebook and Google, that compensation would not only be applied to their news publishing, but if they were to launch a rival to your lifestyle publishing, that would get compensated.
That's accurate.
That's accurate?
That's the mind-boggling part of this.
That's incredible.
It is incredible.
They would be able to launch a competitor to you doing the exact same kind of coverage as you, and they would be getting checks from Facebook and Google, but you'd be excluded.
Correct. Unless we also chose to launch a news masthead that would qualify under the code.
I guess you'd have to consider something like that.
I might need to consider also finding a benefactor. I'm not quite sure where I would extract said resource. But yeah, it is one of the extraordinary, I believe, oversights within that code.
And so that was your concern, that this was bad policy that could wipe out digital first publications like your own. And now, if I understand, you're feeling more optimistic because rather than rely on this legislation, you feel like there might be a door open by Facebook to come and cut a deal with them directly.
I think that that's one thing to feel optimistic about. The other thing that I remain optimistic about is that there appear to continue to be conversations being had with our government. And I am really relieved to see that people do not appear to be defending their turf at all costs in this bid to be right anymore. And there appear to be signals that true negotiation is underway and that they are recognizing that that agreement, as it was drafted, was flawed and requires rework before it's adopted as legislation.
So the policy itself might be improved.
I really hope so.
I'm curious as a journalist about all this, but I'm also self-interested as a publisher. And I feel like when I talk to an Australian, I'm looking into the future. Do you have an understanding in practical terms about how this payment scheme would work if you either are covered by the policy or you strike a deal with Facebook and now you're in? And I take it that not all digital publishers would get in, but let's say you get in. Do you get paid a flat rate? Do you get paid every time you publish an article? Do you get paid based on how much traffic each article gets?
I honestly have no idea about the construct of these deals. And I suspect that they are highly bespoke. I suspect that there isn't a blanket set of rules and criteria. And that is one of the reasons why Facebook really didn't want to find themselves in a position where they were needing to negotiate with every media company, because the precedent that they'd set was quite different rules for different organizations. I have no real knowledge of that. That's me reading between the lines. But in short, I don't know what are the metrics that are being compensated and why.
I've been doing my best to click around and figure it out and read the bill. And I've read everything from like flat rates for 2 years, we're going to give this newspaper this much, to performance-based stuff, not based on click-throughs, because that doesn't get Facebook any money. You know, that helps the publication, but it doesn't help Facebook. So if Facebook is sharing its ad revenue, that ad revenue is based on shares, people sharing the content and engaging with it. And I can only imagine that incentivizes news publishers to publish articles that people don't necessarily read, but which they are more likely to share and comment on.
That's true. I also imagine that Facebook is seeking the credibility that comes along with quality content that appears on their platform. I do think there are hard metrics that they would be willing to compensate publishers for, but I also think it's the halo effect that comes from having revered content brands appearing again within their platform.
If I hear you correctly, having already experienced how delicate and vulnerable you are when you're at the mercy of their algorithm, and that can change overnight without warning, you're wary not to get too dependent. Rupert Murdoch and the big news brands in Australia, just like the big news brands here in Canada, they want to be dependent. They're imagining a future where that's like their major revenue stream.
Yeah, that's true. And that's why the negotiations here with Facebook are falling over at the moment. There's what they're calling a poison pill clause, which is basically Facebook's ability to terminate the agreement without warning.
That does not sound like a very solid, secure future for the news business.
I would not be banking the livelihood of my team on that arrangement, which is why I would really welcome the opportunity to be able to collaborate and produce great things together, but I won't be banking on that to support my revenue.
Susanna, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses. But we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. Okay, so bringing this all back home to Canada now, where you may have noticed the endless newspaper lobby PR campaign against big tech. You may have seen the blank front page publicity stunt that the newspapers pulled a few weeks back, or maybe you just heard me mocking it. But as much as I might ridicule the message, I can't deny that I guess it's working. Our news cartel's pressure campaign has resulted in a number of government policy measures, some promised for the future, some on the table right now. Nobody has been keeping better track of this stuff than my next guest, Michael Geist, University of Ottawa law professor. That is where he holds the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-commerce Law. Hello, Michael. It's good to talk to you again.
It's nice to be back.
As a business owner, as a digital publisher, what do I actually have to be afraid of here?
That's a great question, a great way to start. I think in certain respects, there's both the things we know and then the things that we don't know. And I think both should be a cause for concern if you're in the business that you're in.
Oh, good.
I would say in terms of what we do know is that there is going to be clearly a regulatory environment that is going to capture just about anybody that's offering up, at least at the starting point, offering up online streaming services. And while this is largely framed as something that's designed to capture the Netflixes of the world, the government's taken a very broad approach, and they've essentially said, well, no, anybody who offers up these audiovisual services, wherever they're located, at a minimum is theoretically subject to this new legislation. They're taking the Broadcasting Act and saying the days when the Broadcasting Act applied just to cable companies, satellite companies, and broadcasters is over. We want to apply it to the internet. And so that's going to include everybody, and not just in Canada. It's going to include services located outside of Canada too that have Canadian-based subscribers. They're all part of this broad system. And so within that, there will be a whole series of requirements, unless some of these services get exempted by the CRTC, that all of these services will find themselves subject to.
Okay, hold on. As I understand it, there's like three different parts to what they're going to be doing. This is not the link tax part. This isn't about the news part, or it's not supposed to be the news part. That's a different part that we don't have legislation yet. Australia does, we don't. This is the part where they're taking the system that they had in place for TV broadcasters, where if you want to be a TV broadcaster and make a lot of money selling ads against American content or selling cable subscriptions to American content, you got to kick back a percentage into the CanCon fund, and they make Canadian sitcoms and dramas out of that. The intent, as I understand it, is to apply it to Netflix and things like Netflix. And that's the part you're talking about now. And that's the part that you're saying is going to capture me and anybody doing video on the internet as a business, doing audio on the internet as a business, it's not just going to capture Netflix. I'm going to be regulated by that as well.
Yes, that's right. This is not about the link tax or regulating social media where they provide links back to news services. It's known as Bill C-10. So it's a bill that's currently before the government. It's already gone through two readings in the House of Commons and is now the subject of some committee hearings. And it is seeking to reframe the Broadcasting Act so it no longer applies to conventional broadcasters, cable and satellite, now applies more broadly to the internet. They're redefining what it means to be a broadcaster to include these online broadcasters. They've acknowledged that this could be overbroad. And so they said, well, we'll leave it to the CRTC by and large to determine who might get excluded from the ambit of this legislation. But their starting point is everybody gets captured, everybody registers, everybody has to provide data to the CRTC. And then the CRTC will determine who faces the next step, which could be mandated payments and contributions, so-called discoverability requirements, where they would prioritize Canadian content, let's say, on your Netflix feed. The CRTC would make those kinds of determinations. But the starting point is we're going to capture everybody. And in fact, when the minister, Guy Beau, has said, well, there's thresholds in the bill, candidly, there isn't. The thresholds would by and large be up to the CRTC to decide.
I don't know what to believe, because Guy Beau has, at first he said, when people said to him, are you suggesting that you're going to require every news organization to be licensed? He said, yeah, what's the big deal? And then he walked that back when it was pointed out to him that, like, that's not really kosher in a society with a free press, or by our culture of free expression and free independent press. And then he said, well, I take it back. And he said, this one, C-10, it isn't about news sites. The intent, if I'm not mistaken, is that this is like Netflix isn't paying their fair share. Disney isn't paying their fair share. That's who this is for. But you're saying you can't make a bill that's just for Netflix and Disney. You've got to somehow define who it's for. And that captures me. Anybody making money off of video or audio will be regulated by this, but then the CRTC could determine later to exclude me. Maybe?
Yeah, no, it starts getting complicated pretty quickly. The starting point is this is all about Netflix, but whether they could or couldn't, they decided to create or bring forward a piece of legislation that goes far beyond just Netflix or Disney or some of these other services. It really does capture everyone. The truth is this covers news as well, because what it covers are services that offer up programs, and news, where you're offering up video programs or audio programs, is still captured by this as well. There's no express exclusion of news here either. Sometimes the government likes to say, well, we're not licensing any of this, so be cool, it's okay. What they're doing instead is requiring registration of all of these services. So they're not going to say that you have to get a license. They're going to say you do have to register. And as part of that registration, we've got the right to demand that you provide us with data about your subscriber base, about how much revenue you generate. And that will all be ostensibly about whether or not you might be exempted from the legislation. But this potentially applies to everyone. And note that, you know, you're Canadian based. This in theory applies to all sorts of services located outside the country as well that happen to have Canadian based subscribers.
So in order for me to get that exemption, I first have to register with them, which, again, I don't want to get ideological here, but the idea of me registering my news organization with the CRTC is like a non-starter. Like that makes me want to gag to begin with. But I couldn't get my exclusion unless I registered and said, no, I should be excluded because here's my revenue, I'm news, or whatever. But maybe that's just a philosophical problem. I'm trying to talk about practical considerations. What I'm trying to avoid is a practical consideration where, if I understand you correctly, I would be treated like Netflix in that I'd have to like not only give them all that data, but I'd have to like pay a tax on my revenue, which would then be used to fund Canadian productions, which is hilarious because all I make are Canadian productions. And then they would have power over my content to say, you've got to make certain Canadian content more discoverable to your audience, which is also hilarious because all of our content is Canadian. Also, Bill C-10 does give CRTC regulatory access to regulate my actual content, like the priority of which I place things, which podcast is on the front page and which is on the back.
Well, I think supporters of the bill would say, listen, hold on a second. The CRTC will be very reasonable about all of this and you won't find yourself subject to any of that. And in fact, they may well say, listen, all you have to do is register. The CRTC will have established certain standards. And as long as you fall below those standards, let's say from a threshold perspective, I mean, thinking about revenue, let's say, then some of the more onerous obligations won't apply. Part of the challenge here is that all of this is a big unknown at this stage, right? So the government has a bill. They've said that they're going to provide more specifics in a policy direction that they're going to give to the CRTC. That remains a secret. They haven't released it. And so we don't have any of that information. Then we don't have what the CRTC will do. So the CRTC is indeed empowered to establish the kind of things that you just talked about, discoverability requirements around Canadian content, mandated payments, mandated disclosures. That's all directly included within this legislation. It's the CRTC that will decide what discoverability means, under what circumstances, who it applies to. Government has said, oh, we think we can get all this done within a matter of months. Guilbeault says he's not a patient person. Anybody that is at all familiar with the CRTC knows that we are talking about a process that is going to take years to unfold, likely is going to end up in court challenges, potentially on constitutional grounds. Certainly, whatever the CRTC decides, someone will say, I want a judge to take a look at it. So this is going to be a very lengthy process that I think creates a lot of uncertainty. Maybe not for you. You'll continue to do your thing until you learn otherwise. But certainly for many of the larger services that are out there, they're going to look at this and say the Canadian market is now just super uncertain in terms of the kinds of expectations, the regulations we're going to face. And that's going to be the case for the foreseeable future.
I hear you. And there's all kinds of consequences. But let's just say I don't care about that. I'm just wondering, like, what's this going to mean for me? And what I wonder is, what if I took the position once C-10 is in place that I'm a person on the internet publishing with my charter rights for free expression? And my subscriber base have rights to give me money every month for it. And my advertisers have rights to pay me for it. And I don't recognize the CRTC's rights to even make a determination as to whether I should be excluded or not. I'm not registering with the CRTC. What could happen to me then?
That's a great question. I mean, I don't have a great answer for you other than to say that I don't think you'll be alone in taking that position if that's where we end up. A lot of people, I think, are quite rightly of the view that this is truly regulatory overreach. Ironically, they could have accomplished the kind of goals that we talked about off the top. They wanted Netflix to pay. You could easily get Netflix to pay more taxes and then use that revenue that comes in to help fund the kind of things that you want to fund. Rather than going with sort of that clear-cut tax model, they've instead used this regulated cross-subsidy model. And listen, the CRTC may take the position that we're just going to leave well enough alone and not pursue those kinds of cases. Or they might well decide that if there are many organizations that are subject to the rules that they set out after this process is developed, that are just saying, listen, I'm not going to follow the rules. They're going to look to make an example of someone. And this likely ends up in the courts, where we get the courts deciding whether or not this legislation is even constitutional to begin with.
All right, let's talk about part two of this, which is also way off in the distance. Heritage Minister has said he wants to regulate harmful content.
Yes. So there are really three parts to all of this. There's the broadcast stuff we just talked about. There's the news related linking. And then there is the sort of the world of harm that takes place online. The government took some steps, I guess, prior to the last election with the election registry to try to deal with some of the kind of election advertising that were seen as potentially causing harm. Now they want to go further to deal with not just illegal content, but harmful content. In fact, the minister at one point in time has even suggested that he'd like to deal with hurtful content, you know, along the lines of what's constitutional and what's not. The government saying that it can regulate and hold liable social media sites or other sites for hosting hurtful content strikes me as something that is truly ripe for challenge.
What are they trying to do? What's the intent here?
Well, the intent is to deal with kind of that basket of harms that I think many recognize taking place online. There's the hate online, there's misinformation online, there's cyberbullying that takes place online. And the argument is that the platforms play a significant role in obviously facilitating the distribution, certainly, of that content, and that they ought to play a more aggressive role in countering it. That's not to suggest, I don't think, or at least I hope, they're going to say that they've got to censor everything that appears on their sites, but they are in all likelihood going to say, listen, you've got to be responsive to complaints and take content or remove content with, you know, very short notice. And if you fail to do so, you will be held liable effectively as the publisher of that same content.
So this is aimed at big tech. This is aimed at Facebook and Twitter and those types of forums. Do I also have to worry about a regulatory overreach when they're trying to determine who is a publisher of this harmful content, whereby the content of a podcast could somehow fall under this harmful, hurtful liability? Or can they somehow tailor make this that it only applies to the social media platforms?
The fairest response is we don't know. In part because, of course, there is no legislation yet. And there has been some inconsistency, I think it's fair to say, in terms of some of the language that government and the ministers have used. What we do know is something is forthcoming. And we also know that their approaches to date have not been particularly narrow, let's say. And so they haven't done a good job necessarily of tailoring to a small number of sites or services. And I think it's fair to say that that raises its own set of challenges were they to try to do that. You know, we've got a trade agreement with the United States and the idea that you could target what is quite literally just a handful of U.S. companies for regulation and leave everybody else out is itself subject potentially to challenge. So it's unquestionably a complex area. And overhanging all of that, of course, is that we do have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms. We do have safeguards for people's freedom of expression. And so looking to other jurisdictions and saying, well, I want to do that doesn't always translate very well, given the kinds of constitutional safeguards that we have already in Canada for freedom of expression.
We're in this particular moment where there's some kind of widespread consensus that, you know, oh, the internet's a cesspit and social media is toxic and Trumpism and misinformation and fake news. And to various degrees, it's true that there's all kinds of nasty stuff out there. All of it creates this situation where people, I think, are accepting of something that under any other circumstance, to hear the Minister of Heritage say that he wants to stop hurtful and harmful comments would be like a civil liberty, like you wouldn't last a day from the backlash in a free society. When I look at what politicians in Canada consider hurtful and harmful, it's whenever anybody criticizes their policies or them and they say Twitter is a cesspit. Well, this is one of the most fundamental freedoms we have, is to say very mean things about our elected officials. To give them the power to determine what's harmful or hurtful, it would be a non-starter in any other time that I can think of.
It's quite clear the pendulum has swung, and I think there will be those that would argue that the pendulum had swung too far in the other direction before, that it was an unregulated space and it raised certain concerns. The pendulum's quite clearly swung in the opposite direction, in which the tech companies are viewed as not able to do anything right, and that anything that challenges their position or puts liability on them or blames them for certain ills is seen as sort of a political winner at a minimum. And so we've seen this strong shift in direction without doubt. I think it raises real concerns from a constitutional perspective. And I think that because we're in this minority government situation, expectations that we could well see an election sometime this year, if I had to guess, I would say that part of what's motivating this is a desire to be seen to be doing something. And, you know, the constitutionality of the provisions, which frankly, if you go after hurtful content, you're quite, I think it's hard to see how that would be upheld by a court. But nevertheless, that's someone else's problem down the road. For the moment, it's all about saying, hey, these are a bad bunch of companies and we're the government and we're going to stand up and take action. And it's unfortunate because, as I say, I think on each of these issues, there's room for genuine policies that actually do identify real solutions. I mentioned with respect to contributions for culture, let's say, I think it's about the tax system. If it's about abusive of marketplace positions and the like, it's about using competition law effectively. And if it's about some of the content, especially illegal content, it's about ensuring that companies follow their policies on a consistent basis and that we've got a structure in place that identifies illegal content, not necessarily the awful but lawful content, but the illegal content, and have a system to ensure that that does get appropriately addressed expeditiously and that companies do so on a consistent basis. But yet those kind of more straightforward approaches is not, it seems, what the government's interested in, at least not at the moment.
No, I hear you. I mean, we do not have completely unfettered speech. You can't make a death threat. We have hate speech laws. We have libel laws. If we apply the laws that we currently have, a lot of this nasty stuff that people are so upset about would actually go away. But from what you are describing, we're in an atmosphere now where it feels like there's a certain amount of posturing where even just the way that he's saying, I'm not a patient person and I'm, you know, make big tech pay for it. Just the way our heritage minister is talking about this stuff, it seems like it's very important to show that he's tough and he's going to wrestle them to the ground and get a win. But maybe that actually is, to get back to my practical concerns, a reason for some solace. Like maybe, okay, go let him rattle his saber. None of this is actually going to happen, you know, and if he tries to, it's going to be in the courts for years and I can continue on my merry way, except for the fact of the third piece of this, which takes us back to where we started and back to where the news cycle is at right now. And that is this link tax. And I know we don't have that legislation in place, but the lobbying effort from our newspaper lobby seems to me to be just plagiarized. You know, they're so concerned about intellectual property, I think that Rupert Murdoch might want to have a word with them. It's interesting to remember that Rupert Murdoch wanted to be Zuckerberg once with MySpace and failing at that. Now he's, okay, I'm the champion of journalism in Australia and they've got to pay back their share. And then I look at this ad campaign in Canada from News Media Canada, Facebook and Google have to pay us and journalism, you know, costs money and they took the ad dollars from us. So we're not there yet, but they're very explicitly modeling this after the Australian campaign. And then the Heritage Minister is saying, we're going to do a made in Canada version of what they're doing right now in Australia. What do I have to worry about that, in your opinion, as a digital publisher?
Well, I think that, you know, it's quite clear that the playbook is out there. And while the minister has said that there'll be a made in Canada solution, I actually think that his solution is likely to be, I guess, Australia part two, is the caving by Facebook or the caving by the government or the finding meeting of the minds, however you want to describe it between the two, that has resulted in Facebook saying, well, we're not going to pay for links, but we will pay something. And that may allow us to opt out of this. I think at the end of the day, what Guibeau wants is Facebook to pay something to satisfy the lobbying campaign that you just described. He may need to threaten legislation in order to do it, or he may be able to coax out some sort of agreement from Facebook independently if what he ends up with is something along the lines of what Australia just found, which is to say, well, we'll exclude news from regulation. There won't be a Bill C-10, let's say, for specifically for news, so long as you make some sort of contribution, and we won't charge for the links, but we will find a way to make sure people come away satisfied. And one thing I got to say, I find it somewhat ironic. Guibeau's predecessor as the Heritage Minister was Melanie Joly, who was widely criticized for effectively doing exactly that. Part of her proposal was to go to Netflix and encourage them to invest. They agreed. They said, we'll spend at least $500 million over 5 years on productions in Canada. And she was roundly criticized for having caved to Netflix. Fast forward a couple of years later, and we've got Guibeau basically looking to do much the same thing. Can I find a way to strike a deal with Facebook to get them to pay up a bit?
So to make sure I understand that, and we're looking at this practically play out, so it's a little bit less speculative than our conversation about, you know, how these Canadian bills are going to play out in Canada. We actually look at what's happening in Australia, and tell me if my analysis sounds accurate to you. The government actually came out with the legislation, their bargaining code for news. I got the sense that the issue for Facebook and Google might not have been so much that they want to hold on to their money, that the link tax would force them to cough up. I'm sure that's a concern. But it seemed more that in order for them to comply with this bargaining code, they have to like hand over all kinds of data and actually give news publishers some kind of status in their algorithm. They wouldn't be allowed to push down news results in people's news feeds. They would have to have discoverability requirements. The algorithm is their product. That, to me, seemed like they're never going to agree to that. And that kind of explained to me why Facebook just turned off news and a bunch of other stuff. You are now trying to regulate the very core of what we do here, and we're not going to be opening up our books to government or to news publishers. And so the outcome of that, it seemed to me, was we'll strike side deals. We'll go and shake hands with Rupert Murdoch and figure out a sum that will satisfy him. Google worked out a fee with Murdoch's news outfit, and then Facebook came to an accommodation with the Australian government that said, basically, this legislation will only go into effect if we can't figure out deals with news publishers. Is that about right?
I think it's an accurate description of what took place. And I think you're right to highlight the importance to the companies around the data and the algorithms. And it's quite clear that the inclusion of that within the code for them was viewed as at a minimum as a competitive threat and something they didn't want to comply with. I do think the notion of mere linking was an issue and remains an issue for both of those companies. In Facebook's case, I think they would note that, listen, we don't control any of this, right? It's our users that post these links. In fact, it's very often the publishers themselves that are the ones that are doing the link posting. And so the idea from a commercial perspective that we are liable for something that we have no control over, and in fact, it's the people we're paying that have some amount of control that can essentially feed their bottom line by posting to our service, was seen as highly problematic. And in Google's case, you know, they're striking deals around this showcase product where they say, listen, we don't pay for the links, but what we do pay for is that we'll license the content if you give us greater access to the content, because we don't post full text. Neither of the companies do. And so that, I think, gives them the ability to say, listen, we could license content where there's value add, but not license the links themselves. And that's, I think, how they've managed to find a way to strike it. What's notable in the Canadian context is that those behind the lobbying campaign that you just mentioned have not struck those kinds of deals with Google. And I suspect that the reason is they think that the heritage minister can basically strike a better deal for them.
From Facebook's point of view and Google's, absolutely, beyond handing over the data, if they've got to pay every time somebody throws a link up, then there's no control over how much they pay, as you point out. But I also look at that from the point of view of what it does to the news economy. Like, what is the incentive structure there? If, like you say, the news company can feed their bottom line just by, like, I don't know, just by mass posting, you've just completely tinkered with the incentive structure of news publishing to the point where it's like, okay, well, how can we publish 1,000 articles a day now? Or if it's about users sharing links, then now you're writing news stories that it doesn't matter if people click through to read the full news story. What matters most is that people post them and share them. I can't imagine that having a good effect on the news content. But again, Michael, I'm a practical person wondering how this affects me and my business, and I can see it two different ways. Our listeners earlier heard me speak to an Australian digital news publisher who was very concerned that this was going to be handshake deals between the big players that would potentially leave a moderate-sized independent digital publisher like her out in the cold. But then when Facebook got the government to relent, Facebook actually said something specific about accommodating independent publishers, and she seems optimistic that she could be included. And maybe this is even a new revenue source for a company like Canada Land. Maybe if the newspaper lobby is successful and, you know, let's say that the heritage minister threatens the big tech companies enough that that gives more leverage to the post medias of the world, maybe a guy like me could sneak in. You know, we're well known enough and our revenue might pass the threshold that I could get my own special deal with Google Showcase and with Facebook. I guess maybe that leaves every other smaller person and future upstart out in the cold, or they'll have to somehow figure out some mechanism whereby they have a seat at the table as well. I doubt I'll get the same deal that Post Media gets, but, you know, that's money I didn't used to have. Should I worry about that, or could this be a good thing for me?
I think if we end up seeing the same kind of showdown that we saw in Australia, and we've got a minister that seems to relish the prospect of taking on these companies, so you never know. That's where I do think it's the independent media, the digital publishers and others, that are the ones that are most likely to get caught in the crossfire. There's just simply no doubt that many of those services want the links from these services if they find themselves shut out altogether, because in this battle between giants on either side, at least in Australia, And so the larger media companies here in Canada, that news altogether gets removed, well, then that represents an existential threat, I think, to many of those kinds of publishers. If, on the other hand, what we end up with is some sort of negotiated settlement, then, of course, it would be open to the government to encourage, at a minimum, the companies to ensure that those licensing deals spread the wealth a little bit. I don't know that the government's got a great track record to date on those issues, though. You know, they've launched a number of programs, and some of them were ostensibly there to support some of the independent media. It hasn't played out, I think, as effectively as some had hoped. And we do know that the lobbying and the pressure, quite literally the blank front pages on the physical newspapers, are coming from the really big players. I mean, at the end of the day, they're looking to get paid.
They want to be paid, and they also don't want to be disrupted. You know, I mean, you point out a couple of points of concern. One is absolutely accurate, that the history of whenever there's been some regulatory approach to content in Canada, there's usually some noise made for, like, we'll have some crumbs here for this special interest or that special channel. And then, I don't know, APTN gets put on channel 75 or something, and there's some funding in there for them, but it's very carefully kept in its place. I can't imagine a regime where I've got the smallest seat at the table with whatever coalition of small digital players we are able to put together. Not only do the bigger guys want the bigger pieces, but they're worried about us. And they're the ones with the power at that table. So cloaked under some language of discoverability, they want more than money from Facebook and Google. They're also bargaining for position in people's news feeds. And I can't imagine them not, they have every reason to, leverage their position to define themselves as somehow the first among Canada's news publishers, the most important. They have every reason to try to entrench their positions. I can't see little companies doing well in the long run. I could see it being good for like a trickle of revenue in the short term. And then I'm dependent, if I become reliant on that revenue, on Facebook and Google. I want them to succeed now. I don't want some other news solution to come out and displace them. I need that, whatever 10 to 20% of our revenue we're coming in from there. I'm curious as well as, if I wasn't Canada Land, you know, 7-8 years in as I am now, but if I was Canada Land 7-8 years ago, what this would mean to my entrepreneurial ambitions, if I would even get involved in a space like this, how do you even get that seat at the table, even to bargain as a little guy? Are those rational concerns? Are those practical concerns?
I think they absolutely are. I think across the sectors we've been talking about, this new regulated environment that the government seems to have in mind will, I think, cause many services, big established ones elsewhere and smaller upstart ones here, sometimes to rethink whether or not Canada is the right place to be doing this, given the kinds of rules that are being put into place. As we see this play out, I think it's important to always keep in mind that there is the policy that's designed to address these issues. But I think in 2021, with a minority government, it's the politics that drives this. And if you're a government, do you want to ensure that you get favorable coverage in the Toronto Star and in La Presse and in all the other major markets where you're fighting for seats, or do you care about some of these digital upstarts? We know where the pressure is going to come from, and we know where it has been coming from, and we know what the likely outcome is, certainly in this particular environment. This isn't about ensuring a robust, innovative news ecosystem at the moment. This is about satisfying a very large lobby group.
All right, Michael, thank you so much.
Jesse, thanks so much for having me.
That is your Canada Land. Listen, we do not get media bailout money. We do not collect link taxes. We are paid by some of you. We need your support. If you like this show, click on the link in the show notes or go to canadaland.com/join. We'll send you ad-free podcasts, a pair of socks, and you will be keeping independent media alive in this country. Email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. We're on Twitter at Canada Land, and our website is canadaland.com. If you are not signed up to receive our newsletter, you should, because it's a really quick read that tells you everything we've published each and every week. Jeremy Kessler produced this episode. Our managing editor is Andrea Schmidt. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like this show, please support it.